Hey, this is Max Weinberg from the E Street Band. You're listening to Tramps Like Us, the Bruce Springsteen podcast with Lee McCormick.
Okay, good day. I'm Lee McCormick. Welcome to Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast, episode 112, The River, album review, record 2. Thanks for listening or downloading from the website trampslikeuspod.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you found the show. Stay in touch and updated at our Facebook group page, Tramps Like Us, a Bruce Springsteen podcast. Anthony Porter, Randy Hall, and BJ Cramp are back again to join me in this roundtable album review discussion. I hope you heard the last episode where we discussed record 1. For this episode, me and the fellows are going to break down the 9 songs on record 2 of The River. Bruce Springsteen's 5th record, released October 17th, 1980. A classic double album, you know, bridging the 70s and the 80s, capturing the essence of a live E Street Band show. Bruce advancing his songwriting, bringing the characters we met on his previous records into a new chapter of life, creating a community. Just as Bruce himself personally was searching out the values of commitment and family while struggling with the dreams and freedom of youth that seemed to be fading into darkness and less valuable.
first record dealing with men, women, marriage, children, all the mundane things that, you know, turn life into life. You know? I think I was thinking about how to make these things more than aesthetic ideas in my own life, you know. How do I practically live a life like this, you know, where I make the kind of connections that I'm very frightened of, but that I feel that if I don't make, I'm going to disappear or get lost, you know. A creative life, an imagined life, is not a life, you know. It's merely something you've created, you know. It's merely a story, you know. A story is not a life. A story is just a story. So I was trying to link this stuff up in a way where I thought I could save myself, you know, from my darker inclinations, by moving into an imagined community where people were struggling with all those things in a very real way, you know? And that was the community that I created on the river.
All right, so we're going to go on to record two of The River, right? Record two, we're going to go up with the first song on side three, I guess it would be. This was recorded at the Power Station August 79, and then again in February 1980, point blank.
Say your prayers, little darling. Do you go to bed at night praying that tomorrow everything will be alright? But tomorrow's falling number, your number one by one. You wake up and you're dying. You don't even know what from. Well, they shot you point blank. You've been shot in the back, baby, point blank. You're a fool this time, little girl, that's a fact. Right between.
So, Randy Hall, but you start this one. Your thoughts on Point Blank?
This song, the first time I heard it, I was going through some things with a young lady. And it's so funny now that it's like 25 years since all that happened. Like, I ran into this chick about 12 years after we stopped dating.
Yeah.
And she looked like she'd been ridden hard and put away wet, if I can, can say that.
You can say that. His life.
but it was so funny, like, how Point Blank, you know, that song in particular, you know, I was getting into this album and that song right around the time we dated. So now whenever I hear, can I say your name or is that too mean? Like full name, like, you know, like first, middle, and last. Yeah. Is that too much?
Just no social security number.
Zip code?
No, her name was Melissa, you know, but at any rate, we worked at the radio station in college together.
Her name was Little Darlin.
Little Darlin, yeah. Her name was Little Darlin, and we actually ran the radio station at Harvard on the Hill, otherwise known as Oakland Community College in Farmington, Michigan, together. And we had a hot and heavy romance that went down in flames. And then I ran into her about 12 years after all that. And good God, man, I was like, I dodged a bullet. But as far as the song goes, one thing I always loved about this particular song, whenever he says point blank, it's like, is it Roy on the piano here?
Yeah, it's Roy, yeah.
So Roy, it's like Roy's having a good old time. He's like commentating on the song. Listen to the little, dun, dun, you know, and you know, when he gets real quiet, and he'll like, it's like he's fucking with us.
It's a little call and response there, man, with that little vocal line.
But that's just a real subtle thing I've always enjoyed about this song is Roy's work on this piano. And you know, I guess I don't know if we all have that person in our lives that just you went one way and they went the other, and for them it was for the worse kind of situation. Love the song itself. I mean, it's a little long, but I mean, other than that, it's always been one I've always enjoyed.
Well, there's room for these long songs on record two of this album, right? There's a couple of long ones coming on here, and there might be a bit of an indulgence on a regular single LP, but there's room for them here, right? So I like this. And you were talking about the piano. The intro on this song reminds me a lot of the live version of Prove It All Night from 78 that they were doing with that long piano intro, right? Also, we got Clarence on the triangle, right? So on the triangle, on that Prove It All Night thing is, too, that little intro with the piano there. And it's got the same kind of groove with cross stick with Max kind of thing. So I like that part of this song. You know, first versions were recorded, written and recorded in 78, performed live at the Roxy, one of those LA 78 shows he does this, right? A dark ballad, that rhythm section though, with the piano is just so gorgeous, right? Clarence on the, there's an overdubbed Guerrero, too. You know, those Guerreros, it's like a... like an armadillo, and you're like scratching it with like a spoon on the back of an armadillo back kind of thing. A grill. So there's that in there. It's just subtle, which is great, you know. So I love the way the band is just playing on this is very nice, right? And you get that, you know, obviously the vocal performance encapsulating that lyric, right? It's people being pulled apart kind of thing, right? There's that line in there, one false move, baby, the lights go out. Like, so was she murdered? Was this girl murdered? She's kind of like a junkie. I think there was previous verses. There was previous, a couple of bridges to this, too, in other permutations of this song, right? The story goes Chuck Plotkin actually removed the bridges from this song when they were getting ready to kind of play it for Bruce. Chuck stayed behind, and he kind of cut these bridges out of it, and he played it for Bruce the next day, and Bruce was like, what happened to my bridges? But he's like, I think it kind of feels better with just kind of these simple chords and moving that way. So, you know, that was a bold move to do. Very cinematic, that heavy third verse I can visualize, right, when he calls her out on the dance floor and everything like that, and he's dreaming about the good old days, those magic moments, and then he right back to reality when he calls out to her on the street, and she just kind of, she doesn't answer, right? She's going down kind of thing, right? What about you, BJ?
Yeah, like you said, cinematic. Springsteen was always good at kind of creating a what feels like almost a scene from a movie. Actually, this song, I don't really like the song on the record, honestly. To me, it's kind of long and boring. And Lee, it sounds like you were saying this song was even longer before Chuck Plotkin got to it.
Yeah, like there was a couple other bridges in there. There was a verse definitely about this woman being a junkie kind of thing, right? But they took that out of it, so that's kind of left... up in the air.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the song on the record. I think it's pretty boring, but I can say that this was one of the highlights when I saw the Tom Joad tour and Bruce just did this with an acoustic guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it being one of the highlights of the show. Like, I liked the song a lot more when it was just Bruce and a guitar than I really kind of like this long. It doesn't really go anywhere for me, this song. It's just long and kind of the same thing over and over.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's what I mentioned. Like, there's room for songs like this on this, right? And I think, the move that Chuck Plotkin did cutting those bridges out, BJ, you probably would have liked those bridges in there. He goes into these different chords. What about you, Anthony? Thoughts on Point Blank?
Well, I thought they did a real nice job. That was in Copland, right? There was a scene in Copland playing this.
Was it? Yeah, I think I know there's a couple other songs coming up on this record that were in that movie for sure. I don't know if this
definitely
one was
a scene. There's definitely a scene in Copland where he's playing on the record player, and I always thought that was cool because that's the type of song. It's a late night, you play on your record player kind of song.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even the verse you pointed out, I think that's the point. The song, you could say, kind of drags along the same, but the words, he goes up with that where they start to dance, and then it fades out. Like, he's telling a story. The other thing, and I was thinking of this today, I never thought of it as a girl actually getting shot. He says, I shot you point blank, point blank. I never actually thought of it as someone actually getting shot. I don't know what you guys think of that. If she got shot or...
Well, there's that last verse where he's like, did you forget how to love? Did you forget how to fight point blank? They must have shot you in the head because point blank, bang, bang, baby, you're dead.
Right. I never actually thought she got shot.
Oh, so like the metaphor becomes reality at the end?
I think so, yeah. Like he sees her on the street and she's hanging out with these like street people and junkies. And
that's
she's
interesting,
like,
yeah.
Maybe. Who knows, right?
I always thought it was straight metaphor and they took her soul, basically. But I guess that's what makes it a good thing is that nobody really knows. It's like a beautiful mystery.
That's the thing. Maybe taking those bridges out took out some like key... what do you call it? Expose or
exposition.
Exposition. Yeah. So, you know, taking that out, all of a sudden the listener is just like, oh, I don't know. What's the story now? And it kind of leaves a lot of that stuff open, right?
The idea of losing someone, you know, in that way, you know, we all lost friends and partners. You know, somebody's there and then they're just gone, you know.
You wake up and you're dying. You don't even know what's wrong.
That song makes its bones in the last verse, you know. It really, where I think it really grabs people. Once I dreamed we were together again, baby, you and me. Back home in those old clubs, the way we used to be. We were standing at the bar, it was hard to hear. The band was playing loud, you were shouting something in my ear. I pulled my jacket off as the drummer counted four. He grabbed my hand and pulled me out on the floor. We just stood there and we started dancing slow. I pulled you tighter and swore I'd never let you go. Well, I saw you last night down on the avenue. Your face was in the shadows, but I knew it was you. You were standing in the doorway out of the rain. You didn't answer when I called out your name. You just turned and looked away. Like just another stranger waiting to get blown away, blown blind. Right between the eyes, baby, pouring. Right between the pretty lies they tell. So that was just vivid, you know. And when I nailed that verse, I nailed the song.
All right, so let's move on to second song on side three of The River. This was recorded February, March, and April 1980, Cadillac Ranch.
We'll be right back.
I love this song, man. Tell me about it. I love it that it's next to Point Blank, right? Two kind of death songs, right? This is a song about death, right? Going to that, those big pearly gates in the sky, driving your Cadillac, right, to the junkyard in the sky kind of thing, right? I love that killer drum intro, right? Just those drums that sound so great with Max just playing the hi-hat with the bass drum on the eighth notes, and then Bruce comes in with that killer guitar lick, that reverb guitar kind of thing. You know, the lyrics, embracing death, growing old, right? Going in the Cadillac Ranch, that cemetery. Cadillac Ranch is actually this art kind of thing set up along Route 66. I think it's in Arizona. There's a picture of it in the lyric sheet for the river that comes with it. But it's this place in Arizona along Route 66 where this guy is buried like 12 Cadillacs, like nose first, halfway deep into the ground, 6 feet under the ground, right? So you see these six like tail ends of these Cadillacs, these dead cars kind of thing, right? So there's that metaphor. When I die, baby, throw my body in the back. And drive me to the junkyard in my Cadillac, right? Like, that's how I want to go, too, right? In the back of my car. Mine's probably going to be, like, Ford Crown Vic, but not a Cadillac, but still, same kind of thing, right? I love cars. I love songs with car metaphors. You know, Bruce Springsteen, Chuck Berry, those great songwriting can weave metaphors. Like, is this about a girl? Is this about a car? Are we having fun? Are we having sex? Who knows, right? Listen to Gary playing that percussive bass sound. Sounds like he's playing with a pick. You know, I love it. Just Chuck Berry, Hot Rod, innuendos, all that stuff.
It's a fun song. It's hard to take very seriously. I guess I'm not a huge fan of it. I love, of course, we've got Little Steven on the vocals and Clarence bringing it at the end.
Yeah, when Clarence doubles that lick with that little lick at the end, that's fun, man.
Yeah. It's just a fun song. You know, I could be like a broken record with some of these songs and start talking about all the outtakes that I would have put on the record instead of this.
Right.
But, yeah.
Well, that's the thing, right? Back again to that double record. We have room for these things, right? He's trying to show parts of the live show. Like, he didn't have songs like this in his catalog before The River. So when he was doing his live show, he would have to throw in a Chuck Berry song, a Buddy Holly song. So now he doesn't have to do that because we have Cadillac Ranch for a little fun little jam session in the middle of all these heavy songs, right?
Yeah, we talked about how he's kind of, with this record, he's letting down his hair or whatever. He's not taking it as seriously as he has been. He's been, on the previous records, he's been kind of obsessive about his artistry and, you know, probably about his being taken seriously, you know, and now he's just kind of willing to have fun and jam with the band and not try to be the artiste, you know.
Actually, this is one of my very favorites on the record because I think it's one of the first in chronological order where he would have been almost country Bruce.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think there would have been any references to kind of pack his paw on a gonna pack my paw and I'm gonna pack my hand. It wasn't on any of those records before that. So I think he came out, you know, with that whole kind of countryside, which is a huge thing for me. And then just the way the song opens, I mean, I love the drums and, you know, get the guitar coming in, the piano where it's actual piano, not organ. And, you know, it's just a jam. It's actually one of my favorites on the record.
Man, I got to say, this is like the forefathers to like Working on the Highway in Darlington County that we'd hear on Born in the USA. The band's on fire. Like, if you took the singing and the words out, I mean, this would be just as good, actually, if you ask me.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, I think the E Street Band sounds, like, really locked in here. Like, they found a groove, and they just ride it. And, like, he could be singing about pots and pans or whatever. And it would be just as effective, I mean, to me. Because, I mean, this is just, like, as far as Barroom Bruce goes, to me, this is, like, top shelf for that mode, when he goes into that kind of mode.
Mm-hmm. I love that one verse where he calls out James Dean in the Mercury 49 from Rebel Without a Cause, and Junior Johnson, he's, like, a NASCAR guy, and he's got the Burt Reynolds. And the Black Trans Am. Yeah. And a cool little thing, when he plays, like, Australia, he'll swap out, like, Burt Reynolds for Mad Max when he's playing in Australia. Mm-hmm. All right, next song on side three. Was recorded late 79 and then early 1980. This is I'm a Rocker.
In a fair shade.
I wrote down, do you think John Cafferty heard this song?
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's like On the Dark Side is almost just like a rewrite of this.
That organ part is like deedly 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 deedly. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is kind of the template for John Cafferty, really.
For sure.
A song like this. This is another fun one, but it's like, it should be, a song like this should be like 2 minutes long. You know, it should just be in and out. It goes on a little long. I think that's what we get with on this album, in a way, is the band jamming in the studio, having fun, and that kind of leads to some of the songs going on too long.
Yeah.
And but yeah, this is a fun song.
Well, I of all the rocker songs I like the best, I always thought this one, in terms of, you know, you always say he wrote like 100 songs for this record, sounds like one you wrote just kind of thumbing through the TV guide.
Yeah.
You know, Columbo, you know, it's got Columbo and Kojak. And you know what I mean? It's just a writing tool that, and it gets to the chorus, which doesn't necessarily have to do with all the, you know, Columbo split and you can't buy Kojak. I'm a rocker. It's one of those. It works as it is, but when you're writing songs, sometimes you're just throwing in a verse lyric. I also think, and because like I said on the other show, this is my favorite Bruce record. I like the recording of his vocal is so clear on where you know all the words. Whereas this one, he's mumbling. In that first verse, he goes, I got a Batmobile, so I can beat you in the back face.
Yeah.
Like, he almost knows that maybe he's just sort of gibberish in the verses, but it's cool because it's Batmobile. and it's just a good rock song, but that's, I always sort of thought of that one from a songwriting point of view, that maybe he just sort of was sitting at the TV one night, and you just string those words together, and they're kind of cool, and even now, you know, if you listen to it now, because they're all even classic TV shows like Kojak and stuff like that, which would have been, I guess, even 10 years ahead of this record, but you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So I always liked it for that. It feels tied together, but it's not as much of a story as a lot of the other songs.
We were talking last episode about, you know, Ramones and Hungry Heart and what they could have done off this record. This is one they could have done, because, I mean, it's got that kind of sci-fi, cartoony kind of comic book, like Ramones-esque kind of funny, goofy lyrics, right?
Yeah, this probably started with the chorus. He had the chorus, and then he just had the figure out what the hell the words for the verses were going to be, and this is what he ended up with.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably didn't put a ton of time into it. You picture a lot of the songs on this record, you picture all the guys are looking at a piece of paper as they're playing it. Like, they don't know these songs. They're probably all...
A lot of these songs, like this one, Cadillac Ranch, like they came in the second batch of that session when he knew he was going to the double album. He was like, okay, we need some like party rockers in there, so we need like 5 or 6 of these kind of things in there.
I like all the stomping and hand clapping, and that adds a bit of fun to the whole proceeding. It is like, I don't know, you can either look at it one of two ways. It's either more of the same, like coming right on the heels of Cadillac Ranch, or just kind of like a logical extension of the song before it, if you want to be more gratuitous toward or charitable toward the sequence of the songs here. I mean, as far as Barroom Bruce goes, to me, this is one of the slider songs. I kind of like the Spy references, but, you know, that's because I'm a man, you know, or boy. So that stuff to me is cool. But if he's going to be playing the party rock, this is not the one I'm hoping he's playing. To be totally honest with you, I wouldn't call it a throwaway, but it's throwaway's next door neighbor, disposable.
You know, Max right off the top with the surf beat on the drums, right? It's garage rock. You know, you got that 60s organ lick in there, which is played by Roy, right? No Danny on this track. He was AWOL for this session for some reason. So it's just Roy doing all the piano and organ on this. You know, hand claps are never a bad idea, right? Lots of good hand claps on this. And the cool, clever rhymes. Right? We talked about the TV kind of show references. There's also that one line like, I don't care what shape you're in. If they put up a roadblock, I'm going to parachute in, right? All that stuff is so funny. Yeah. Cool, right?
That's clever.
It goes up to that organ solo of Roy on the Farfisa, right? And it does a little modulation. Goes up, builds it for the solo, and then comes right back down for that last verse, right? And, you know, Bruce would always make this work live. You know, I remember I saw him, Randy, you mentioned like you wouldn't want to see him do this live. I saw him in Hamilton, maybe was that 2012, I think. I think it was a sign request and he hadn't played in forever. And it was so fun just to hear him bust this out and kind of get through the lyrics. And he's playing it without a guitar and he's kind of, you know, mugging for the crowd and everything. And, you know, so fun. I think it's a good one. You know, Max and Gary doubling up on the eighth notes there at the end for that, you know, take it out rock and roll style. I'm a rocker. There we go. All right. So moving on to... fourth song here on side C. This was recorded March and April 1980. This is a Fade Away.
Now you say you found another man who does things to you that I can't. And that no matter what I do, it's all over now between me and you, girl. Well, I can't believe what you say. No, I can't believe what you say. Cause baby, I don't
feel. Well, my favorite part of the whole song, I love the organ. The organ just sets the whole song. Like, as soon as it comes in, you're like, all right, I know what sort of this song's going to feel like. And I like the feel of it. In a way, sung from a guy's point of view, she's giving up on him. He's not giving up on her. A lot of times in songs, it's, you know, the girl, don't leave. But he's like, she's leaving him and he's kind of saying, nah, you know, I don't want to give up yet. You know what I mean? I always thought that was a little kind of sad, but optimistic. If that makes sense. And that's, yes, I like that, you know, and especially after it comes off those two, Cadillac Ranch and Rocker, it goes way down. It's cool like that.
Well, I don't know if he did this on purpose, but knowing Bruce, he probably did. But like when I'm a Rocker's, you know, exiting, and not Fade Away is entering, like the organ, it sounds like the same organ tone when he goes from one end to the next.
Same key. I wonder what key it is. Yeah, I don't know offhand. Yeah, maybe.
Because I always kind of noticed that, because the songs are, you know, diametrically opposed as far as tempo and everything else. Mm-hmm. But listening to, like, not Fade Away, I mean, it's okay. I mean, I would say it's not on the par of like a Independence Day. I mean, it's just kind of like, I can't believe that this was the second and last single from this album. That's the,
yeah.
I mean, that's the chart hound in me, because I've always, when I was growing up, I gave a lot of credence to the charts, not so much of an adult, but yeah, it's, to me, this was a weird choice for a second single, but as a song on this album, like, you know, it's got a pretty good ear hook. Like, or what do they call that? It's got a, like the actual, I don't want to fade away.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I don't want to fade away. You know, that's kind of an earworm. That's what I'm trying to say. It's a mild earworm, you know. It won't drive you crazy. I mean, I get the point of the song. It's basically, he just doesn't want to be forgotten. Like, if he runs into this lady later, you know, if they can't work it out, he just doesn't want to be a useless memory. For some reason, it's important to him that she look back fondly on this time and not regard him as just like a footnote of her life. I don't, maybe it was just the mood he was in or what, but that's kind of a weird sentiment for someone like him who probably dated thousands of women, you know. But I mean, as a song, it comes and goes. It can be enjoyable. Hopefully I'm not crapping on like somebody's favorite song here, but it's just, if we're going to do a slower Bruce song, I want Independence Day.
I can't stand this song. I think this is awful. this is probably my least favorite Springsteen song, probably this song and Man's Job. Loving You's a Man's Job. Like, oh, those two, yeah. Songs. This song particularly, I can't stand this song. This is weak, soft Bruce. I don't like this, man. This is terrible. Like, the first verse is like, he's like, you say you found another man who does things to you that I can't do, right? So, like, this dude ain't satisfying his girl, right? He needs, like, some lessons in cunnilingus or something like that, right? like, come on. Like, his ex-girlfriend is with this other guy, and so this guy's whining, right? He can't let it go. He just move on, buddy. Find another chick. You know what I'm saying, right? And the way he's singing, like, he sounds like this is like Elvis Costello crap. It's weak. Like, where does this guy get the balls to call himself Elvis? Hey, like, fuck you, Elvis Costello. Give me a break, right?
I just see Lee grabbing this dude by the lapels and shaking him and say, snap out of it, motherfucker.
He's like, if I don't have her, I'm going to fade away. Like, ugh, like, come on. Like, it should be girl, you're going to fade away, and I'm going to move on with my life, right? Like, this is soft. Like, the one thing I'll say, like, at that the Danny's organ part is nice. That lick is really sweet. Like, doo-doo. That's the nice earworm. That's very nice, right? And Steve's background vocals are really good. Like, I know this is one of Steve's favorite songs. I don't get it, man. And like you said, the second single, and Be True is the B-side? That's the B-side? Are you kidding me? Oh, man. Like, I don't know, man.
Switch them.
Like, I just don't dig the lyric. I can't relate to it. Like, I detest the Elvis Costello style of this singing.
Well, I love Elvis Costello, for starters. I think, you know, I wasn't really thinking about the lyrics, but I think this song has a good arrangement and good melodies, and for my money, it's way better than Marry You or Point Blank in terms of similar songs on the record. This song has way better melodies and a much better arrangement, much more interesting arrangement than those other songs, but I knew that Lee was going to go off, because if I remember right, we did a Rock and or Roll Worst the Bruce episode where you picked this as the worst Bruce song. I think this was your number one. So, yeah. But yeah, the single choice is baffling. I mean, the fact that after they had a hit, they just put this out, and then just the label just said, well, I guess
that's
we're going to have to move on to the next Bruce record. Just gave up on this record that's just full of singles, you know? Like we were talking about Two Hearts, Independence Day. You know, there's couple of songs coming up too that would have made great singles. So yeah, the record label really blew it.
And I mean, he toured for a year straight on it. Like, he did 150 shows. He was over in Europe. I mean, like, in Europe they released The River, and they released a couple more singles when he went over there. But
yeah, sometimes you see that over the course of history, you see where a single tanks and the record label just says, well, I guess that record's over, you know, and then they just give up on it when there's definitely other potential hit singles on this album. That
so many singles, yeah.
They really blew it. But yeah, as a song, I don't think this is a bad song.
All right, so let's go to the last song on side three. This was recorded January, February, April, and May 1980. This is Stolen Car.
I met a little girl and I settled down in a little house out on the edge of town. We got married and swore we'd never part, and little by little other's hearts. At first I thought it was just restlessness that would fade as time went by, and our love grew deep. In the end it was something more. I'm driving a stolen car down on Eldridge Avenue. Each night I wait to get caught, but I never do.
This one is, and another one coming up, Drive All Night, are the ones I remember from Copland. I saw that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, those are the two. Freddie has this record. He loves The River. He's always got that on his turntable, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Freddy. Fry yeah.
Stallone. Freddy.
Yes, Freddy.
Yeah. Good old Freddy. He for some reason, it just loves the crap out of this song. But, you know, it actually, you know, brought, shone a light on it for me. Now, to me, lyrically, this is like what happens when the characters from the river grow up a little bit, you know. Like, you force these two kids to get married, and they kind of, like, drift apart. And then, you know, one person is just, I mean, they feel alienated from each other, but the guy is so desperate to feel something and to feel alive again that he's going out stealing cars and just doing really dangerous behavior, just trying to, you know, kind of like numb himself. He's numbing himself, but he wants to feel because he's not getting that from his relationship. And is, of course, when his wife refers to the letters that he wrote, you know, made her feel 100 years old. I mean, she's suffering too. And I don't know if any of you guys have Catholics in your life, but I went to a Catholic school growing up, and they don't believe in divorce. So, I mean, the people in this song are going through a lot of existential trauma. I mean, it's always been like a real touching song, and one you would listen to like with headphones. You wouldn't be like, you know, driving down Highway 65, cranking this bad boy up. I mean, you'd want to put on your nice headphones and just kind of like take it in, kind of thing.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about the lyrics and what you got out of it there, Randy, and maybe what Anthony and BJ thought as well. Because when I always heard this song, I always thought it was a guy. It's this guy. It's a man in his thoughts, right? His inner thoughts. He's got these inner conflicts, like stay or leave kind of thing, right? Like he had a happy wife and a family, but then they drifted apart, well, you know, little by little. So he's driving this stolen car. But I always thought that he's trying to get caught. Like, he wants to go to jail because that's his easy way out of this marriage, this thing. Like, just throw me in jail and then, you know, I can get away. But he's, like, so down on his luck that he can't even get arrested. He's one of those guys. I'm out here stealing cars. I'm trying to get caught, but I can't even do that right kind of thing. Right? So that's what I always got from it, instead of this guy just wants to feel rowdy and alive. It works both ways. I can't think, you know,
I think he's ambivalent. Like, part of him wants to get caught, but part of him doesn't want to get caught.
He wants to free himself from this family, this marriage anyway. Two chords in this song, right? It's a classic two chord song. It's hard to write a song with two chords, right? I know BJ, you like variety, but try and write a song with two chords, like Jambalaya, Copperhead Road. Even try to write a song with one chord, but this one goes back and forth between like a G and a C. It's almost barely even two chords, because he plays like it's in G, and then it's not C, but it's like a C over a G with a G on the bottom, right? So if you're playing a G chord, and then you're taking your fingers 1 and 2, and you're playing that C with the G on the bottom, right? So you still got the G on the top and the bottom, but in the middle you got the C, right? So you're playing. Going back and that, back and forth. Still just like the G and the C and the chorus.
Driving a stone car down on.
Right? Just those two chords. And then at the very end, when they're doing the outro fade, right, you hear a little organ there, and the organ goes down to the. Like, it goes down to an E minor, so he just hits that E minor chord just as the song's fading out. I always love that one. Right? They took a couple of cracks at this song in 79 when Clear Mountain was engineering, and you can hear that on the Ties That Bind box set. And then another mix of that version came out on the Tracks box set, which has some accordion on it, and it's kind of more of a country feel. But this, I think, is the version that he captured on the river. It's very dark, and, you know, the way Rory's playing these little piano parts under the vocal line, and Max is soft on the floor toms and the rack toms, and, you know, the way Gary's playing the bass. It's like the E Street Band is not only a bar band, they're like great studio musicians, kind of here, right? BJ, what do you think of this one?
Yeah, I love this song. I think it's brilliant. And I remember, Lee, you said the river was kind of a precursor to Nebraska, but this song is really kind of the leads to Nebraska, I think, more than anything. I mean, this is the exact kind of story he's mining on Nebraska. This could almost be the same character. Like, I was thinking, yeah, it seems like this guy, he's driving in a stolen car, and yeah, he's just throwing himself to the hands of fate. Like, what, you know, if I get pulled over, fuck it. But it's almost like he's hoping for suicide by cop, maybe even, you know. But he's definitely, he wants something to happen. And you could almost say that this is like the prequel to State Trooper. Like, yep. In this song, the guy's depressed and kind of defeated, but then he gets pissed. And the State Trooper is where he's just like daring the cop to pull him over, yeah. You know?
I can dig that, yeah.
But yeah, I love this song. I think it's so cool, and it's a perfect example of the way, you know, the cinematic nature of a Springsteen song, where you really feel like you're in a movie. You really feel this song, you know. It's brilliant, I think.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those songs. When I first heard it in 86, 12 years old, I probably like skipped this one. I'm like, I can't get into this. But, you know, years on, this is one of my favorites as well. Anthony, right. What do you think?
I said cinematic too in my notes. That's what I like about the words of this one. And then when you said it's kind of like Jambalaya, I'm gonna have to look up the more country version. I always thought this was sort of a Hank, like if you up-tempo it a little, it's a Hank Williams song, you know. I met a little girl and we settled down. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Song structure, lyrically, it's right to the point. And you get to that hook, it'd be like, I'm driving a stolen car. Now Hank Williams would play all major chords. He wouldn't play that G with a C on top. But that's what I always thought of that. It was, again, I use that reference a lot for this record is Country Bruce, but that's a big influence on him. And I always sort of thought that one had that sort of Hank Williams, you know, he lost the girl. And then you say, you know, what was the meaning of it? I just always took it as he's down to his last dollar. He's just driving around. He stole the car. He does not care. And which, again, like you said, you heard at 12. I probably heard around the same age, where it just doesn't – it didn't get me at that age, but I appreciate it as I listen to it older. But, you know, you're 8 or 10 or 12, and you're like, I don't really get this one. You don't at 8 or 10, you're not stealing a car. You don't know anything about that. But, yeah, that's what I always thought of. I'm going to have to look that up. I'm going to try to find if there's a more country
version. Speak for yourself. I grew up in Detroit.
All right, let's go on to the last side. Let's flip the record. Side 4 kicks off with a song that was recorded back in June, August, and September 1979. And then again, they touched it up in April 1980. Start your engines. This is Ramrod. I got to kick this one off. One of my favorite songs. Holy cow, Ramrod. This is one of the best of the bar band rockers on this. That intro with Bruce counting it off. 1, 2, 3, 4. That guitar lick. And the band kicks it in. We got some reverb, Dwayne Eddy guitar there. You know, got Danny. He's got that classic little organ lick underneath there. Probably my first favorite song off the record when I first heard it. I was just like, yeah, this is the one, man. Hot Rod song, right? Sounds like the engine of a muscle car. That sax kind of revving up. Motor humming, right? Bass playing with a pick. You know, Saturday night, we got to let our ramrods rock. The blurred lines between a sexy woman and a hot rod car, right? The first verse he's talking about is a little Dolly with the blue jeans on, how he wants to take her out and party. We're going to have we've been working all week. We're going to have a good time, right? And then the second verse, he starts describing his real love, right? She's a Hemi with a four on the floor, right? She's a Roadrunner engine in a 32 Ford. And, you know, late at night when he's dead on the line, he thinks of the pretty face and he lets her unwind, right? So you guys know what a Hemi engine is? You know these lyrics, breaking them down, a Hemi?
Yeah, I know, so that he says it in Born to Run.
Like the cylinder where a piston shoots. Yeah, if you had a flat head, the cylinder would be flat. But a Hemi engine, the cylinder is like a rounded, like hemispherical. That's like the half circle cylinder head. And what that does, it kind of maximizes the volume and minimizes the surface area so it can heat up quicker, right? Allowing the spark plugs to fire quicker. Pistons can move faster. There's hot step and Hemi, four on the floor. So four on the floor is manual engine, right? Four speed, right? You know, hot rod engines, they would have four speeds instead of your regular car would have like a three speed engine. Right, so you would have like a four on the floor, so you have four gears and a reverse on the floor shifter kind of thing. And then we're talking about a Roadrunner engine in a 32 Ford. We're talking about a Plymouth Roadrunner, right? That's like a muscle car from the late 60s. Plymouth Roadrunner, that was like one of the, you know, that's a tough muscle car. We're talking about a 383 cubic engine, maybe a 440 engine, like just one of the, like a hot rocking, you know, fast car. So he would take this Plymouth Roadrunner engine and then he would put it in a 32 Ford, like a Deuce Coupe, right? Like that yellow Deuce Coupe from American Graffiti. All right, so these are just brilliant lyrics. Come on. You know what I'm talking about? BJ, your thoughts on Ramrod?
Oh, you already know. We've had our run-ins over songs like this. I believe it was on my show when me and Brian Sword were probably giving you a hard time about this song, and you were like, you guys probably don't even know how to change the oil in your car.
Well, do you know how to change the oil in your car, BJ? It's probably not.
I've never changed the oil.
You haven't learned since then?
I would just fuck it up and need a new car. So, yeah, you know, this song is not my bag. It's not very melodic, and I don't want to learn about engines when I'm listening to a song. It's not really what I'm looking for. I'd rather listen to Elvis Costello lyrics.
Oh, man.
I love this song. Because, you know, they're just out there stomping. And as far as lyrics, you know, to quote the great David Lee Roth, it might be about a car, it might be about a girl, it's all about you. Well, it's all about you. That's what you're not quite sure with this one. But he's up, you know, he's just up there stomping. And I love the sax.
Oh, man.
This is probably my favorite sax solo on this. When they get, by the time they get to the sax, that band is up and surfing. And Clarence comes in and it's just like, man, this is probably my favorite of the up tempo. He comes in with that sax, yeah, and he's just killing it.
Bruce calls him out. Bruce is like, "Big man."
I just love that. Like when that comes in, I don't know how many people would play air sax while they're driving, but you play air sax with this.
Sometimes I'd write something just to hear Clarence play a particular type of solo. You know.
Big man.
We were schooled on the sax solos from the Dion records and very, very specific, you know, melodically. We wanted those kind of classic sax solos where you could come away humming them after you heard them a few times. The songs where you create a very kind of classic melody and it would be more of a composed, written piece, very similar to the way we built solos on Born to Run or Darkness on the Edge of Town.
And then the other thing about Ramrod is, like Hungry Heart, I think it was sped up a little bit on the recording, because if you're trying to play guitar with it, it seems like the song's in F sharp, but when they play it live, it's always F. And F sharp, like F sharp B and C sharp, doesn't make sense for like a 1-4-5 progression on a song like this. So I don't know. It seems like they sped it up a little bit. And you'll see when they play it live, it's been at various tempos over the years. Like in 80, 81, it was a little quicker. And then, like, if you hear it, like, on the reunion tour 2000, it's, like, really slow. They really dropped it back in the groove. So, little thing there about speeding it up and then the key change. F sharp, where it should be. I think it's originally recorded in F.
So, who was Bruce, his manager at that time?
John Landau, co-producer.
Yeah, so it's almost like John Landau came to Bruce with a challenge and a mission. It's like he said, Bruce, do you want to be featured at every single car show for the next 50 years? You need to write a song that car lovers and enthusiasts will blast for the rest of all time. And then he went into the lab wherever he goes, and came out with Ramrod. But, you know, I did a really deep dive on these lyrics, and what I came out with, I don't know if you guys would agree, but I think he's talking about sexual intercourse. I don't think he's talking about a car at all.
It's the same thing, dude.
Double entendre.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, I mean, that's, I'm you know, but, you know, if I was at an outdoor venue and he came out and he pulled out Ramrod, not whatever he calls Ramrod, I would, you know, I would look at the ladies in the crowd dancing, because that is what this song is made for. It's made for the ladies and the car enthusiasts and Lee McCormick. And as far as that goes, that's just fine by me.
This live, they usually do this like 12, 14, 15 minutes, man.
But that would get me talking at Guantanamo. 15-minute version of Ramrod. I would start spilling
followed
my
by
guts.
A 20-minute version of Meet Me at Mary's Place. Man, that's half hour of your life you're never getting back, DJ.
All right, next track was recorded in June of 79 and April of 80. This is The Price You Pay.
I love this song, of course. It sounds really great. The production is great and lots of great melodies. I love the pause in the verses. You know, he's like, you make up your mind, pause, you choose the chance you take. Like, that's a great melodic choice.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
Over the chords. And one thing I noticed that I never noticed before was when the harmonica comes in towards the end, it sounds a lot like The Promised Land. And then the very next line in the song after that part, he says, little girl down on the strand with that pretty little baby in your hands, do you remember the story of the Promised Land?
Yeah.
And it's right before he says that, it sounds very similar. It made me think of Promised Land. I was thinking of this. I was like, oh, that sounds like Promised Land. And then the next line, he said The Promised Land.
Oh, that's cool.
And I kind of doubt that's an accident, honestly, which is pretty cool to think that he's using the same characters,
same motifs and the words. Yeah.
But yeah, I love this song, and this would have been another great single, you know. I think, but yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I also love the song, and I actually love the harmonica solo. I love the harmonica anyway, it's an instrument, but I think I love that solo. And I think it's funny when it goes from Ramrod, which is all sax, and we're going to go to Price You Pay with a harmonica. And I know this is probably way overthinking it, but you've got your band there, and you're like, no, we're just not going to put a sax on there. You can sit this one out, Clarence, and he'd go, okay, I'm going to play the harp, just from a band point of view. But I love the harmonica solo in this. And I also, I was just thinking of this, I have a cool cover. Emmylou Harris does a cool cover of this on, I have it on one of my playlists, but I like this song a lot. The words are really good.
To me, this has always been like my secret Bruce song. I mean, unless somebody's a real Bruce fan, most people don't even know this song, which is astounding to me that it's not more well known. On my old podcast, In Another Life, that Dandy Classic Music Hour, we did a Bruce Springsteen show where we were doing, I think, our top 15 favorite Bruce songs, and there were three of us on there. It's before I knew you, Lee. I would have invited you.
Yeah, I'm sure. But, thanks.
But The Price You Pay, I want to say, was 5 or 6 for me of my favorite Bruce songs of all time. I mean, lyrically speaking, it's always hit me. You know, one of the most misunderstood lyrics for so long. I don't know why I didn't look at the lyric sheet, but you know, the counts that men fall away.
I thought he was saying the councilman falling away. I'm like, damn, Bruce is getting political. And then when I saw the real lyric, I was a little disappointed. But, you know, it makes more sense, that real lyric. But,
yeah.
I mean, this song, like, we all have a price we pay for anything, like, be it success, be it failure. You know, you have the pain of discipline or the pain of regret. And he kind of like alludes to it throughout, but you know, he's using a woman and maybe your child is kind of like a lyrical focal point. But you know, everybody has a price they have to pay for whatever they become, good, bad, or indifferent. And it's just a mid-tempo song, but he doesn't have a lot of songs like this in his catalog that are this poignant. So I'm a big fan of this song.
Yeah, another cool drum intro. Oh, 3 and 4
yet again.
Down, down. Right, 12-string guitars on this sound really good off the top. Electric 12-strings. There's a little lick in there that I didn't get until maybe I saw him live do this. When I remember when he played this, the 2016 show, and they played this live. I actually kind of rolled a tear because I love this song a lot too. The lyrics mean a lot to me. But that little, the main lick is like down, 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 down. Right, but there's a lick that kind of the counter melody when he played live, they kind of, you can hear it more, goes. So that goes on underneath that lick. It's very subtle, but you can hear it there. I always just get a kick out of that little lick there. But yeah, the religious connotations in the lyrics, right? Little girl on the strand, baby in her hand, promised land, desert sands, right? That's like when Moses and the Israelites, they paid a price for challenging God's ways, right? Is it that Israelites, right? Israelites, right? Those guys.
Biblical and political.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, everything you do has cause and effect, right? Making a choice, paying the consequence, living with your decisions, you know, learning to sleep at night with the price you pay. Like, these are lyrics that, you know, I can really relate to. I'm sure a lot of people can. You know, if you give up a family life for a dream or vice versa, give up a dream for a family life, right? You know, Miami Steve singing on this is just heavenly, right? Just those he's like an angel singing on. We talked earlier about how he's the Keith Richards to Bruce, you know, to Bruce's Mick. But on this one, he sounds like an angel just soaring with these these background vocals, right? Coming to terms with choices, you know, come to Jesus moment.
A little more call and response with the piano even in there, especially at the end.
Yeah. And you hear Bruce doubling his vocals at certain parts, right? There's a breakdown part, you know, that third verse where he's alone, but then he comes back in and he's doubling his voice, and then Steve in there with the backgrounds. It's really great. And of course, that last line, you know, girl, before the end of the day, I'm going to tear it down and throw it away, right? That's the best. All right, next song we're going to. This was recorded way back in June 77. Atlantic Studios in New York, and it was recorded a couple months later, August 77, The Record Plant, with Jimmy Iovine, the Little Lizard, was working on this record. And then again, the Power Station, February, March 1980, Drive All Night.
When I lost you, honey, sometimes I think I lost my guts too. Yeah, I wish God would send me a word, send me something I'm lying in the heat of the night, like prisoners all our lives. I get shivers down my spine, girl, and all I wanna do is hold you tight.
taste your tender charm. And I just wanna sleep tonight again in your arms. Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Drive all night. Yeah, I think the lyric "drive all night just to buy you some shoes" is a classic. I like it. I like it because it's a little. It's definitely different for this record. It's a real, almost like a old school bluesy song. I don't want to sound pretentious and say, but if you had some real like a 50s style belter, it's almost like he can't reach what he wants to do on the melody. You know what I mean? I know this will sound pretentious, but like an Etta James who can hit all those notes. Could you imagine her doing that song? Yeah, I always cool. thought that what he was going for, and I love the sax at the end.
This is another Copland one. Freddie put on the old record player and would lose himself in. Yeah, I mean, I see him do this live, and it was crazy, man. Like, because you just don't. When you go to a Bruce show, it's mostly Bruce fans. You know, there's some Fairweather fans or younger people, but you know, there's always at least half of the people in there, you know, live and die with Bruce Springsteen. So when he pulls out this song, I mean, it was like the whole crowd hushed and like let him do it, you know?
Yeah, nice.
And I've always loved this song too. Like, I know it's super slow. Do you say it's the slowest song in his catalog?
It could be. I was trying to think. I don't know what else could be slower than this song.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to really. I mean, if anybody would know, it'd probably be you. But like the part that tears at my heartstrings is, you know, when he goes, "You got my love, oh girl, you got my love," and he like, you know, works himself up into a lather, you know, where he's, you know, screaming heart and soul.
Yeah, I love that. And heart and soul.
Yeah, you're like, man, he's like in a different dimension right now. Kind of situation.
He's giving her.
But and then he brings it back down, and then he kind of like retreats again, and then he comes back with a little less impassioned version of that. But you know, it's definitely cinematic to, you know, to ride on y'all's theme coattails there. It really, I mean, it was made for a movie like Copland, where Freddy's the kind of character who, he's like somebody the river would be about. You know, I guess that's what the director was going for too. But yeah, this song's excellent as well.
Yeah, so this one was written like 76, 77, Darkness Sessions, right? Performed live New Year's Eve, 77 in New Jersey. He recorded it with Jimmy Iovine. They tried to better it for the River Sessions, but they couldn't do it. And it was that groove, that rhythm section of, you know, it's basically piano, bass, and drums carrying this song, right? And that's actually Bruce playing piano. So we have Bruce Springsteen on piano, Gary and Max doing that groove, and it's very tough to make a song sit like that, right in that groove, playing that slow, man. It's, you know, it's easy to play fast, it's hard to play slow. This guy's lamenting, his girl is gone, he's lamenting how much he still wants her, right? He wants to hold her tight, he'd do anything, he'd drive all night, right, through the rain and the snow and the wind, all that stuff, right, just to buy her some shoes, right? And the three chords just going around and around, circular, building those dynamics up, right? And that sax solo, probably the second best sax solo on the record, next to Ramrod, I would say, you know? Another great emotive solo.
Sax kills at the end.
Yeah, just soars and just matches that vocal that Bruce is trying to give there. You know, that Bruce, that underrated soul singer, great singing on this. And the other thing I want to mention too is there's an instrument on this, it sounds like a synthesizer, so this could be the very first synthesizer on a Springsteen record. It's like a glockenspiel thing at the end. It's weird though. It's definitely like a keyboardy synth kind of sound, right? Similar sentiment to Fade Away, but it just doesn't seem as weak as that one.
It might be a mild precursor to like the Tunnel of Love kind of sound he would do, I guess it would be 7 years later.
Yeah, or Born in the USA, getting in those keyboard sounds, right?
Definitely.
Well, the vocal performance is definitely the centerpiece of this song. Kind of everything was riding on that vocal. So he really had to deliver, because that's pretty much all there is to the song. For the most part, it all comes down to his vocal performance. And yeah, I think it's a great vocal. I think it really works. And he really had to, you know, give it his all, because that's really all the song is, you know, is that vocal until the end. So,
all right. Epic, epic ballad. All right, we got the last song on side four, last song on the record. This was recorded right at the end of the sessions, April 10th, 11th, and 12th, 1980. This is Wreck on the Highway.
Last night.
I've always thought this was like a really, it's like a dot, dot, dot way to end your album, you know, like a foreboding, kind of like, it's like unresolved way to end the album. I mean, as a song itself, it's pretty good, you know. He's basically, another like Nebraska maybe forerunner here, because I could see him, you know, doing a song like this definitely on Nebraska. It has the same kind of tone. He's basically just saying, look, he saw a wreck on the highway, and it made me think of how grateful I am to have you, is kind of like what you get at the end. But it's just like all the music is to me, is just very pensive. I like the song, and I don't know if I would have ended the album on this note, but you know, Bruce had his reasons, I'm sure.
I like it as a kind of album closer. It's just kind of this nice little piece that kind of ends the record. Like, you know, you would think Drive All Night might be the epic long song to end it, but he just kind of, you know, puts this quiet little moment on the end of the record, which I think is neat. You know, Wreck on the Highway is very country, 50s, 60s kind of tragedy song. Like, that was a thing back then, right? Tragedy songs like Give My Love to Rose by Johnny Cash is a very similar story to this song. Right, an accident on the side of the road and a guy comes upon it. Last Kiss is another one of those songs. Ebony Eyes, right? Roy Acuff actually had a song called Wreck on the Highway from early 40s. You know, Springsteen recorded this one really quickly. The band recorded it quickly. You know, it's a few takes only. Like, man with his inner thoughts, he witnessed something, and he's just kind of reflecting. You know, we're all on borrowed time. Like, life, it's limited. Right? The strong organ that Danny's playing carries the counter melody against the vocal. And I think very cinematic, right? I can visualize the accident, right? I can see the highway. I can see the cop at the door knocking on the middle of the night, right? I can see the guy looking at his wife as she sleeps, kind of thing, in the middle of the night.
This song is brutal. I mean, it's almost cruel to the listener. You get to the end of the record, and this is what you're left with at the end. I mean, it's hard to listen to. It's the kind of... I love the song, but... you know, you don't always want to listen to this because it really leaves you with a terrible feeling.
It's one of those things you don't want to think about, but it's reality, right? It's life. It happens every day, but it's like you don't really want to invite it into your world.
kind of funny that, you know, I mean, there's a lot of upbeat stuff on this record. There's a lot of party songs. You get to the end, and it's like Debbie Downer at the end.
That's what I was trying to say, but I, you know.
Yeah,
you said it more eloquently.
But I love the song. I mean, it's a great melody and it's incredibly well done. It's well executed. It works, but it's also very depressing, you know, which sometimes you want. I mean, there's tons of depressing Bruce songs. There's, you know, Bruce is one of the only guys who there's probably 10 Bruce songs that I can barely listen to without crying. I mean, just last night at work, I was listening to Howard Stern. And Howard Stern started to talk about Tougher Than the Rest and how it makes him cry. And he started playing it, and I'm at work, and I can't really hear that song. I mean, I'm on the verge of tears as soon as I hear that song.
Yeah, I hear
and
you.
I'm like, yeah, I don't want to be feeling this way at work right now, you know?
I hear you.
So you got to kind of pick and choose your moments with stuff like this. But
right. I just think the way it's placed, and if you're going to sit down and listen to this full album, like spend an hour and a half with this record, this nice little moment is...
I guess if you're going to put this song anywhere, put it at the end. Mm-hmm. That's true. Because it was in the middle of the record, you know, put this in between like Cadillac Ratchet, I'm a Rocker. Like Stolen Car is depressing in a lot of ways too, but it's much more, it's imagery and feeling and mood, atmosphere. This song is just literal, to the point, there's a dead guy on the side of the road, you know. There's not a, it's not open to interpretation.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it's like if you listen, like those songs I mentioned, if you listen to any of those old 50s tragedy songs, they're just as like hardcore as this. And even more
it's like
so.
A trope, a country music trope almost.
Yeah. And some of those songs have like, are in major keys and they have nice melodies, right. but you listen to the lyric and you're like, oh my God, what are they singing about?
Yeah. One of my favorite things ever is there's a, from Lawrence Welk. There's this group, they're singing Bye Bye Love by the Everly Brothers.
Yeah.
And it's so upbeat. They all have these huge smiles on their faces. And the lyrics to the song couldn't be more depressing, you know?
Yeah, so, this girl's cheating on them. Yeah.
The contrast is hilarious with some of the stuff like that.
Yeah. Anthony, I'll give you the last word on Wreck on the Highway.
Well, I go both on both sides, and I love what you're talking about. I thought of it as old school, like almost like a Hank Williams style, only it would be all major key and happy. And then you'd be listening to it, go, wait a minute. So we found him dead. Like, you'd sing it a couple times, and you go, oh, okay. And I would, as the last song on the record, and we're talking about listening to it at work, this is one that probably wouldn't have made it onto the cassette I would have made to take to work.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it sort of guts you. You know, you're working, you're trying to get your work done. All of a sudden this would come on, you'd be like, oh, man, I got to sit down. So maybe it didn't make it to every cassette that I would have taken to work. But that's – so I have a sort of – I don't want to say love, hate. I don't hate it, but I don't know. Being the last song, I probably wouldn't always put it on the cassette. And you guys all know what I'm talking about, like where you'd have to – you'd buy their LP, the vinyl, and you'd put it on a cassette to take to work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. I want to make sure I'm not giving you an old guy reference or something.
Oh, yeah. I used to always have extra batteries with me and everything everywhere I went. You know, the Walkman, a bunch of tapes, extra batteries instead of the headphones. It's in case the headphones conk out.
You have to have the record at home, like the good copy that you can preserve. And then you have to make the music portable, right? Make it mobile.
Exactly. Yeah.
Bring it in your car.
I would buy the album and then immediately put it on a cassette tape to take to work. And then the album would get played only at home.
Yeah.
A kid today would not understand that, but
yeah, I had almost everything on cassette at one point because everything revolved around a Walkman for me. Like when I was in college and stuff, it's like, you know, I'd have my backpack with 10 cassettes in there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just head out for the day.
One good thing about, you know, closing this record this way, when I saw him play this show live and do the record in its entirety, this was a nice little song to wrap up that part of the show. And he kind of went into a little spiel about how this song kind of summed up the album. It's like a quiet reckoning between the singer and the listener of the album. It's kind of you know, and it sums it all up in that little song, like love, life, and death, you know, all together in that song, you know.
All the four songs at the on the last side of the record are all summational, you know. They all are goodbyes in one style or another. It was one of those songs you wrote, didn't know what to do with. It seemed like a small piece. It was just this little gem, and then it kind of came up and ended up closing the record. It was, you know, love and death, life and death. I wanted the record to break down to that at the end, at the very end. You have your love song, Drive All Night. And then there's just this quiet reckoning that this character has internally, you know, with themselves on a particular evening when kind of the what's at stake in life is made vivid to them, you know. It's got that. Last night I was out driving, coming home at the end. was riding along through the drizzling rain on the deserted stretch, County Tulane, when I came upon her wreck on the highway. There was blood and glass all over. There was nobody there but me. As the rain tumbled down hard and cold, I seen a young man lying by the side of the road. He cried, "Mister, won't you help me, please?" Finally came and took him to Riverside. I watched as they drove him away, and I thought of a girlfriend or a young wife, a state trooper knocking in the middle of the night to say her baby died in a wreck on the highway. Sometimes I sit up in the darkness and I watch my baby if she sleeps. Then I climb in bed and I hold her tight, just lay her awake in the middle of the night, thinking about her wreck on the highway. So that was, I just wanted to leave the listeners with their thoughts, you know, that the stakes of the record sort of boil down to life, death, love, you know, time, limited amount of time that you have. It felt right. It felt right.
Let's each pick our least favorite and favorite songs off the record. So I'm going to go first with my least favorite, Fade Away. Get that thing out of there. Get Fade Away off this record. I don't want any kind of Elvis Costello sound and shit on my Springsteen records. Put Be True on there instead, and we got a 12 out of 10 record instead of a 10 out of 10. Fade Away, my least favorite. What about you, Anthony? Least favorite song off the river.
I think Stolen Car is my least favorite. Whoa. On the record. You got to understand, I know I went on when we started the other one. This is my favorite Bruce record. It's the one I would have listened to the most. So to say it's my least favorite,
I hear you.
It's still, I like them all. Well, like I said, I wouldn't have always put Wreck on the Highway on my cassette only because it's so kind of down. And then, so I don't want to say anything's my least favorite. They're not skippers in my book. This is my favorite record. So that's that's probably my least favorite was Stolen Car. But I don't want to dog any of the songs in here because I really love this record.
Yeah, it's not a bad song. It's just not as good song.
Yeah.
Randy, yeah. What's your most not as good song on this record?
Yeah, there's no Man's Job on here.
Right.
I have to pick one. I guess it's a two-way tie for I'm a Rocker and I Want to Marry You. I mean, I can appreciate them both at certain times, and they both have their uses, but, I mean, you got to pick something, so.
Right. BJ, your least favorite song on the river.
Yeah, definitely I Want to Marry You is my least favorite. I just think the song is annoying. Yeah. And, Lee, you're so mad at that wimp and Fade Away. Well, the guy that I Want to Marry You,
I think...
No, but the guy and I Want to Marry You is just sitting on the side of the street having some beers, fantasizing about a girl walking down the street. He's not like writing her letters. He's not stalking outside her house.
Yeah, no, it's the same guy. Yeah, she says no, and then he's Fade Away. And then he's the guy in Fade Away. It's the same wimp, though.
All right, so let's go to our favorite song off the record now. This was tough because, you know, for a while there was Price You Pay. After I saw him live, like in 2016, Price You Pay made such a big impact on me. I was going to say Price You Pay, but, you know, those rockers, the bar band songs on this is really what made me a Springsteen fan, like back in the early days when I was a little kid. Like, I just love Springsteen rock and roll bar band stuff. So it'd have to be probably You Can Look, But You Better Not Touch. You know, Ramrod is up there too. I love Ramrod. Oh my God. What can I choose? I'm going to go with You Can Look. You Can Look, But You Better Not Touch. That's got to be my favorite. That's the song that's going to be played, you know, at my wedding, at my funeral, at my graduation, at my my 30-year anniversary at work, and any kind of occasion where I can play a song by Bruce Springsteen, I'm probably going to play that one.
It'll be a my wedding, one. My funeral, my 30th anniversary at work.
Yeah.
That's so versatile.
Hopefully I won't attend any of those occasions, you know? Anthony, your favorite song?
My favorite is Ties That Bind or Cadillac Ranch. That's, like you said, what got me into Bruce. And this is really the record, I think, I probably said in the first episode that I was very aware of Bruce. Like, I knew that earlier stuff, Born to Run and stuff. But this is the one where I thought, whoa, he's really got something going on here. As an age, you know, 1980, of hearing that Ties That Bind for the first time. And it was like a lightning bolt moment for me. Like, oh, listen to the words of that. So that's my favorite on this record, Ties That Bind.
Nice.
Followed by Cadillac Ranch.
I guess that'd be no surprise when I say The Price You Pay. It's probably anticlimactic, but it's always been my favorite song on this record, with a respectful nod toward The River, because that's just such a great song. I mean, you gotta give it its due.
How about you, BJ? Favorite song off The River?
Ties That Bind. It's just, I mean, it's the first song, but it's just so great. Everything about it is so great. The melody, the vocals, the band, the guitar licks, the lyrics. It's just, I love it so much. It's one of my all-time favorites of any Bruce song, so...
The record, final thoughts from me. I love this record. It's my third favorite Springsteen record. I got it at a young age. It was like probably the second or third Springsteen album that I owned. You know, it holds up. The songs that I didn't like then, I love now. You know, I love every song. Like I said, perfect summertime record. Sounds good in the summertime. Sounds good coming into your car stereo with the windows down, you know. What can I say? This record sustains. And that tour in 2016 was probably one of my favorite concerts I've ever seen. Seeing Springsteen and the E Street Band perform this record, you know, in its entirety, on stage, live. A lot of these songs made a bigger impact seeing them at that concert. So, you know, it remains one of my favorite records.
Well, I was thinking back to when I first, you know, got into Bruce and got into this album and thinking, you know, before tracks, before all this stuff came out, back when I would read about all the outtakes and not know if I'd ever get to hear them. And now that I've heard so much, just this whole period of his career is just fascinating. And I've been obsessed with it for a long time, you know. So, and like I said at some point, it's hard to separate for me the record from all the other songs. I mean, if you take it all, the cumulative nature of everything he recorded and wrote all during this period, it's just all, you know, some of my favorite stuff by anyone ever. So but if I just think about the specific record, you know, I would have switched out some of these songs for others that he left off, and there's certain songs that he left off the album that it's kind of baffling. Like Lee, you've mentioned Be True a couple times. I mean, I think that's one of his best songs.
Yeah.
And it's pretty funny to see somebody who has a song that good and doesn't put it on their record. It's kind of fascinating, though.
On a double album.
Yeah. Well, but that was always one of the cool things about Bruce, back then in the 90s, knowing about, there were all these legendary songs that you hadn't heard,
right, yeah,
that you just would read about, and it was so cool. It's kind of different now that we've heard so much of it, and it's interesting to think back to the time where it was just kind of a legend. Yeah, it was this.
It's all a mystery. You didn't know what, you didn't know when it was recorded. You didn't know how it was all related. Now we kind of have it, and we have all this literature and, you know, and books, and we can find out and put the story together, the big picture together, kind of thing, right? Which I think is interesting on the other side of that coin. Now that we're looking at it, you know, with it all, we don't even have it all yet, but with a lot of it, you know, at our fingertips now.
I think that really contributed to my appreciation of Bruce when I first got into him.
Yeah.
Was that he was this figure who had all this legendary stuff in the vault, you know, kind of the same way Prince was always had that reputation too.
Right.
All the great music that's just buried in a vault, because, you know, there's these kind of eccentric geniuses who, you know, Bruce would just shit can a whole record. You know, you'd hear it, you'd be like, who does that?
Well, if I haven't said it a million times, this is probably my favorite record, all, you know, song for song. I had a wonderful time chatting with you guys about it. I actually went back, listened to it like in order for the last couple of weeks, where normally I think you get out of that, and so much of it lives in your head. Like, the records you really dug into at a young age just live in your brain all the time. But when you say, oh, I'm going to put this on and just listen to it song after song after song, it was real nice. So I really enjoyed chatting with you guys about it.
All right.
Yeah, like Anthony said, it's good to listen to it the way that Bruce intended. And the thing about Bruce, he is very kind about contextualizing a lot of his art for us, whereas a lot of artists don't go that extra mile, or they don't want to for whatever reason. I couldn't see somebody like David Byrne doing that kind of care with his with the Talking Heads like Bruce does with his stuff. But all that to say, like, after we talked in part one, I was trying to think what albums of his I like better than this, and it ended up at number 6, in case anybody cares. My favorite Bruce album is Darkness on the Edge of Town, the one that immediately preceded it. And it's just amazing that from, you know, when he went through all that lawsuit stuff with Mike Appel, how much he had to, like, hold back from the public, you know?
Disciplined, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that he had, of course, Darkness on the Edge of Town, which to me, it's all killer, no filler on there. Maybe Factory, I guess you could argue, but even that song is pretty good. But then you got this, you know, this is him just letting his hair down while he's emoting. Like, this is the most eclectic album to me. The other albums, I guess, I like, I love Magic. I love the new album, Born to Run, Born in the USA. I mean, those are the only ones I like better than this.
You like the new album better than The River?
I do, man.
Like Letter to You? You like Letter to You better than The River?
I do.
Wow.
I know.
That's all good. I can't argue. It's all good, but that's a little surprising.
For some reason, that album, like, it just hit me, maybe at the right time in my life or something.
Yeah, they'll get you.
But all that to say, like, this, it's just, even the, this, I had a hard time picking a worse song, which over the course of 20 songs, that's pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You think about it.
Yeah. Solid record, man. Well, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate your time over these last couple episodes, really getting in deep with one of my favorite records, and I think one of Springsteen's best. So, Anthony Porter, thank you.
Thank you.
Randy Hall, thank you very much, my friend.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And BJ Cramp, always great talking.
Thanks, Lee. Yeah, it was great.
Was time. I was sitting with a friend of mine last night, and he said, time comes to us all. and the river was about the ticking of that time and how we each have a finite amount of it to do our jobs, to raise our family, to do something good. That's a river.
That's the show, folks. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at trampslikeuspod.com, communicate with us on Facebook at our Tramps Like Us podcast group page. Tramps Like Us podcast is a nonprofit audio fanzine created by fans for fans and is available for free. We are not affiliated with Bruce Springsteen or Columbia Sony Records. If you've heard any music you like, please find it and purchase it from brucespringsteen.net, Amazon, your local record store, or wherever music is sold. As always, gratitude and respect to Bruce Springsteen and all past and current members of the heart-stopping, pants-dropping, hard-rocking, booty-shaking, earth-quaking, love-making, Viagra-taking, history-making, testifying, death-defying, legendary E Street Band.
After the sessions, you know, Bruce would say, let's go to the book. I got more songs, you know, let's go through them. Yeah, so we sit at the piano, he'd open up a book of, you know, ideas, you know. And you'd have 25 ideas in there.
Her mama's yapping in-